You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
The Global Drug Survey is the largest drug survey in the world. It is independently run by a group of researchers and academics, averaging around 100,000 participants each year. The survey produces reports for global media and public health organizations using their data and expertise to create digital health applications that deliver screening and brief interventions for drugs and alcohol, as well as creating free online harm reduction resources and anonymous, confidential self-assessment tools. I spoke to Adam Winstock, a London-based consultant psychiatrist, addiction medicine specialist, and founder of the Global Drug Survey about this year's survey and what they hope to achieve. I started off by asking him what exactly the Global Drug Survey is.
So the Global Drug Survey is the biggest drug survey in the world, and we're now in year six. And basically it works by us partnering with a whole huge media organisations around the world who promote our survey in 10 different languages for about 6 weeks at the end of every year. And we then share that data with the media organisations and the rest of the world a few months later, normally in May, June of each year. And we tell people what's going on with the world of drugs. And I guess what's different about the Global Drug Survey compared to most drug surveys is that we're not funded by government. We're not obsessed by drug-related harm. Our mission is to help people who choose to use drugs do so more safely. And we ask things that are interesting to people who use drugs. And it's interesting to us too.
So you said it's been running for about 6 years, right? You know, are there some massive changes coming out of the data that you've been noticing in habits or, you know, way people are doing things now over the past 6 years?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were lucky. We started really just as the world of drugs was about to change forever. So I think the three big things that we've been able to track has been, one, the appearance of darknet markets, so kind of Silk Road and people being able to access good quality drugs online without going through street dealers. And the work we've shown is that more and more people are buying drugs on the dark net each year. But really, whether or not people buy drugs on the dark net reflects the kind of country's drug policy. So, for example, in Sweden and Norway, huge numbers of people will buy drugs on the dark net compared to really low numbers in a country where, like Portugal, where you can just buy drugs on the street. Interestingly, New Zealand has relatively low levels of buying drugs on the dark net, and I think that's because you've got such tight borders and you've got such a strong working relationship between your police and your postal service. Mm. I mean, trying to get anything into New Zealand is nigh on impossible. I arrived for a conference in New Zealand 10 years ago with an apple in my bag, and I'd only come over from Sydney, and I got fined $200. The second change would obviously be the huge increase in the number of new drugs that have been notified around the world. And we've been tracking the appearance and impact of drugs like synthetic cannabis products for the last 5 or 6 years. And I think one of the biggest findings that we've been able to share is that synthetic cannabis products, which were obviously huge in New Zealand, just aren't nice. The risk of turning up to an emergency department on synthetic cannabis products is at least 30 times higher than natural high-potency cannabis. The risk of you running into problems like dependence and withdrawal is way higher. So if I look at what New Zealand did with its, you know, attempts at regulation, it was such a brave thing to do, but I think, damn, you probably tried to regulate the wrong drug.
Yeah.
So that would be the second thing. And I guess the third thing, and it probably hasn't hit New Zealand in the same way, is that huge reemergence of high-quality MDMA and high-dose MDMA pills, which has caused lots of problems across Europe and the UK, where people are ending up taking way too much. And the reason I guess I say that probably hasn't hit New Zealand is one of the things New Zealand tops the Global Drug Survey in every single year is you have the most expensive cocaine and MDMA in the world by a factor of at least five.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I've read a lot of stuff about New Zealand's, you know, sort of drug use and thing. And I think also for us, it's like, you know, like it's a geographical thing. We're so far away from the sort of hubs of those sort of drugs that it's A, impossible to get anything through our border security because of our biosecurity, because of our environment and stuff, but also just the sheer, you know, transportation of covering that much mileage to even get here is ridiculous. And I mean, we're such a small population that I don't think, you know, people are, it's kind of a hard thing to say.
It's not worth the effort.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not worth the effort for a cocaine dealing ring. You're absolutely right. But the consequence of that is that New Zealand has a couple of problems that you don't see elsewhere. So, you know, the best source of quality pharmaceuticals are prescription drugs for many people in Australia, which is why we see, you know, high rates of prescription opioid misuse, tramadol use, benzo use, and why we also see lots of people cooking up their own sorts of drugs, whether that's home-baked crystal meth or things like poppy tea. So I think New Zealand's geographical isolation protects it from some things, but increases its use of other substances. I mean, people use what's available.
Mm.
And, of course, there's alcohol and weed.
What are the main objectives out of the survey? Would you say it's addiction treatment or reducing harm or both or a mixture of things?
It's absolutely reducing harm. So to my day job as an addiction psychiatrist, so I work with people whose lives have been ruined by drugs.
Mm.
But the truth is that 90% of people who use drugs will never develop serious problems and certainly will never come along and see somebody like me. But it doesn't mean to say those people don't need good advice and good information to help them use drugs more safely. And so the Global Drug Survey is actually trying to fill that gap, because governments aren't really interested in the kind of hidden masses of drug users. They're interested in people who commit crime, overdose, die, go to jail, end up needing methadone or, you know, alcohol detoxes. And what Global Drug Survey is about is everyone else. And it's trying to get information to them. So it's getting information to people who drink too much, saying, well, how can you drink a little less? How can you use weed more, you know, more safely? If you're going to use MDMA, how can you reduce your risks? And, you know, for new drugs that were such a big issue in New Zealand, it's about what exactly are the risks and also what's the impact of policy? You know, and I can tell you that Global Drug Survey looked at what happened when New Zealand repealed those drug laws. You know, the number of people in New Zealand using novel drugs just plummeted.
Mm.
But what you were left with was a group of people who continued to use the synthetic cannabis products because they were cheap, they were being dealt, and people became dependent and ran into all sorts of problems. And that experience has been replicated elsewhere, where people don't like synthetic cannabis products. Getting stoned on natural weed is much nicer. And now in the UK, what we've got is a bunch of people who are continuing to use synthetic cannabis products because they're cheap and because they're being knocked out at a huge profit. And New Zealand kind of signaled that that was going to be what happened before the rest of the world knew it.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, every year, do you sort of like, are there specific objectives in each survey that you put out in terms of what you want to know? Are you adapting the survey every year?
Yeah, so there's like a core bit of the survey that looks at prices and purchases, kind of who ends up in A&E and things. And then every year we look at kind of bits and pieces that are really, I know, kind of like just particularly interesting that year. So this year, the four things that we're focusing on in the specialist section. So when you get through the first 20 minutes or so, you get kind of given a selection of other things. And this year we're looking at cannabis legalization. So we're asking cannabis users around the world, how would you actually want to see cannabis regulated in your country? And that's really important because no one asks real experts. So that's one. Two, we're going to look at cannabis as medicine in the real world. So if you're using it, what condition, what do you use, how often do you use, how effective is it, do you have any side effects? The third thing is drug vaping. So everyone seems to think that the only drugs you can vape are kind of nicotine and cannabis. That's not the case. And so we're looking at other drugs that people are using. And then the fourth thing is we've got a lovely little section on psychedelics. So we're looking at the whole issue of people microdosing with LSD and magic mushrooms to improve creativity and work performance. We're looking at people's use of ayahuasca. And finally, we're trying to understand what people mean when they say they have a bad trip. Because psychedelics get a bad name because of this idea of a bad trip. And the truth is there is a big difference between someone having a difficult experience when taking a psychedelic and having a bad trip. And part of the reason people are exploring psychedelics as treatment for difficult emotional conditions like depression or PTSD is that it can allow people to process difficult emotions in a way that ultimately can allow for transformation and growth. So we're working with some psychedelic expert groups to try and understand what people mean when they talk about difficult or bad. So yeah, that will be really interesting stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And I think about that that sort of psychedelic stuff is I definitely noticed that discourse popping up in the media a lot this year about using LSD to treat PTSD and using MDMA. And I think it almost felt like there was a bit of a psychedelic revival, you know, like in this, you know, new age with these people who are trying to almost find alternative you know, solutions to their problems and stuff. I was also wondering, because I did notice in the survey there was a question about contraceptive, oral contraceptive. Is that something you look at every year, or was that new this year?
No. So one of the other things that we've been able to highlight over the last couple of years is that women seem much more vulnerable to ending up in emergency departments after using MDMA than men. Mm. I mean, like, young women are 2 to 3 times more likely to end up in hospital. And we're trying to figure out why. And it's probably got something to do with estrogen and other hormones affecting women differently. But we also thought we better find out whether or not it might be something to do with people taking, you know, oral contraceptives. So, and that's because what we want to do is we want to advise young women, if you're going to use MDMA, it might make a difference where you are in your menstrual cycle to whether or not you're going to have a good or a bad time. It might be that being on a pill may increase or decrease your risk. We simply don't know. And it's really difficult to do that research unless you can get access to 30,000-40,000 MDMA users. But we can. So, I'm well spotted. That's a really important thing we're trying to find out this year so we can share that information.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's really great. And I think it's such an important thing to consider because I think people forget about that. You know, when people think about drug using, they go online and they read, you know, trip reports or whatever on those websites. And it's, you know, I think it's hard to forget, you know, people can act completely differently, which I think also those reports sort of show as well. But it's like good to sort of have a solid and investigative body looking into that, because, you know, people just running off random stories they read on the internet about people's personal experiences, you know, is kind of 50-50, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. There's a difference between one person's experience and the experience of 50,000 people. Mm. And I guess that we're trying to give people, you know, an idea of what the range of experience, but what the real risks are. So, you know, like, you know, we know that 90% of people who end up in A&E when they do MDMA have taken other drugs. We know that people who do MDMA more than every month are much more likely to mix with ketamine, crystal and coke, and they're more likely to end up in A&E. So, you know, we can turn around to people and say, if you don't want to end up in A&E or you want to reduce your risks, don't use more than, you know, every kind of, you know, 4 or 8 weeks, don't mix with lots of alcohol, don't mix with coke, blah, blah, blah. And really importantly, if you follow those simple bits of advice, you're also likely to have a better time. Because I think that's the other thing that Global Drug Survey understands and accepts, is that pleasure drives drug use, not harm reduction, you know, not the avoidance of harm. And so we're really happy to say to people, actually, if you use drugs like this, you're likely to have more fun as well. Because that's ultimately why people go out at night and drink and take drugs. It's not, oh, how am I going to do this and not end up in hospital? It's going to be, how am I going to go out and have a really good night? And fine. Yeah. We're really happy to have that conversation and give you some, you know, tips. I mean, most people work it out for themselves, but lots of people don't. So we just give them a bit of information to help them make that decision.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, I guess this is so broad, but what would you like to see be done either, you know, domestically in the UK, in New Zealand or globally to sort of reduce drug harm? What do you think are sort of the key things that need to happen?
I think it's just kind of honesty is the best policy, you know? And so the first thing I would want to see, and this is on the back of a big nightclub in London called Fabric having been closed down because of MDMA-related deaths and recently being allowed to reopen, but with really punitive kind of rules, you know, effectively going zero tolerance for drugs. And actually what I'd like to see is legislation from the police and licensing that would be applicable to nightclubs, pubs, people who run festivals. And the legislation would be, if you are going to run a large event where there are people here drinking and likely to take drugs, it is mandatory for you to have information on your website about how to use drugs more safely. And you will have your staff not just trained in responsible service of alcohol, you will have your staff trained in how to recognize and respond to risk related to drugs. And that should be put down in law. So instead of the current situation where if a promoter or a bar owner phones up local police and says, you know what, I think I might have a bit of a problem with coke in my club, they'll lose their license, they get shut down.
Yeah.
What you have is a different situation. And the reason that's so important is there's lots of good places to get really good information about drugs. Global Drug Survey, Aeroid, Blue Light, Tripsit, whatever. But lots of people don't bother.
Mm.
And if you had all of that information there on all the big kind of club websites, promoter websites, venue websites, people would go, I'm waiting for 2 minutes for my ticket to download or whatever. I'm going to go and get a little bit of information. That's kind of what I'd like to see. And I think I'd just like to see governments being a little bit more honest. I understand changing drug laws is difficult. It's politically a bit risky. You know, there can be some backlash. But at least governments could go, look, even though drugs are illegal at the moment and we're looking at how things might change, we want to protect people. And so what we're now happy to do is start having an honest dialogue with you. So we, you know, the reason we don't want young people doing drugs is because the brain's developing and they're more vulnerable to harm. You know, the reason we don't want people smoking weed every day is that, you know, 10% of people get dependent and, you know, it can kind of reduce the potential in your life and make you emotionally distant. But if you smoke weed every now and then on a Friday, hey, you're probably not that much of a problem. If you've got a mental illness, it's a bit of a difference. It's just being honest with people. The idea that you can ban drugs and that's the only way of reducing drug-related harm is just, it's just not true. It's outdated. It doesn't work. To just start treating your population like adults.
Yeah.
You know, people who use drugs want to have fun. They don't want to ruin their lives or anyone else's.
If you would like to join the 90,000 others who have already participated in this year's survey, head to globaldrugsurvey.com. The survey is confidential and they do not collect your location or IP address.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.